What's up, everybody? Welcome to Show Me the Meaning, Wisecrack's mostly movie podcast.
Show me the meaning!
My name is Jared, and I'm joined here with the Show Me the Meaning crew. We got Austin.
Yo, 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 yo.
And introducing our Wisecrack producer, Evan.
Hello, nice to be on the podcast.
Yeah, nice to have you, Evan. So today we're doing something a little bit different. A couple podcasts ago, I was talking to Austin offline, and he mentioned that, you know, I knew he was playing The Last of Us Part 2, and I asked him what he thought about it, and he made a passing remark that, you know, it had affected him more than any movie had this year, so, you know, it's definitely, this game especially, is akin to a cinematic experience, so I figured, hell, let's just do it for the movie podcast.
Damn straight. I mean, don't you think that there is a sense in which, you know, it was a few years ago, it was common for people to be like, I think it was Tom Hanks that went on like a live show, and then it kind of just went viral. They'd be like, theater is for actors, film is for directors, and TV is for writers. And the whole idea was that, like, you know, the best writing that's happening right now is in television. And I wonder if you couldn't say that there's something starting to rival that with video games. You know, you've got like the new God of War game that was amazing. You've got this. Evan and I were just talking beforehand about like the most recent Uncharted game. Like, the writing in the video game world is pretty fucking phenomenal. I mean, even something like Alan Wake back in the day, the writing is amazing, yeah. Right? So, I don't
totally.
Know.
Yeah, absolutely. So today we are covering The Last of Us Part 2, the 2020 game directed by Neil Druckmann, starring Ashley Johnson and Laura Bailey. So I want to hear just what your overall experience was with the game. I mean, there's a lot of controversy with this game. It seems to have divided a fan base. I want to get an idea of where you guys stand on whether the game was a success or not. So let's start with Evan.
So this is kind of my first venture into this type of game. Growing up, I mostly played just like Nintendo stuff, like kind of like Pokemon stuff, like geared towards, you know, a younger audience. And so seeing that the second one was coming out and that I had a PS4 that was originally purchased as a Kingdom Hearts machine, I was just like, you know what, I might as well, you know, buy the first game, play through. I've always heard a lot of great things about it. Never been interested in quote unquote zombie content, but you know, I'll play it, and then we'll play the second game because it looks beautiful, and you know, I'm definitely at least there for that. So I played the first game, really liked it, and then was just so excited to roll right into the second one. And I was really liking the second one a lot. Obviously, there's the big the narrative shift to Abby, and I think I dislike that for different reasons than most people dislike. But yeah, it, you know, the game is brutal, and as much as, you know, you want to, hate Abby, as you play her, and those fights where you do fight against Ellie or you do fight against Abby, I did find myself just like in those moments where you gotta mash square, just not wanting to mash square. I was like, I don't want to hurt these people. I don't want to do anything to either of these characters at this point because they've both gone through so much. And so my initial takeaway from the game was, I was like, man, I didn't love where it all shaped up. And then I let it like sit for a few days. And I've come to really, I think, appreciate and admire it overall.
Okay, very cool. What about you, Austin?
First, we just got to say, spoilers.
Yeah, it wasn't mentioned, so I was trying to withhold it, and then I was like...
Yeah, so turn off right now if you don't want spoilers, and there are important spoilers, I think, in this game. So stop now. Yeah, okay. So I've played the first game back in like 2015, 2016, and I only played the first like half hour of it. And it was enough for me to get, you know, when Joel's daughter dies. And that to me, I was like, what the fuck? I literally cried. I was like, this is fucking insane. I was at my buddy's house in Scotland. Shout out to Andy if you're listening. And I was like, this is fucking crazy. Like, what is going on? The game was – it felt so real. It was so immersive and it was so affective. I was like, fuck, man. But I was only there for a short amount of time doing some work on a film, and then I had to leave. So I was like, all right, I'd love to pick this up at another point, but I don't allow myself to play video games that much because I love them so much and I don't have the time to immerse myself in video games, because what will happen is what recently happened to me. I decided to take a week off of work and I went into a video game hole that was supposed to only last for like 5 days, maybe 6 days, maybe 7 days. It lasted for 10 days and literally I just played video games. I will just tell you, I finished The Last of Us Part 2 in 2 days. No.
Oh my gosh. Yeah.
I finished it in 2 days. That's like 25 hours of straight gameplay.
Yeah.
Over 2 days. Right. So
where did you pause?
Dude, I don't even remember, actually.
It's all a blur.
No, it's all one. It's all one.
Yeah.
But I decided that I was going to take this time off because it's a staycation. I can't go anywhere, right? I was like, oh, shoot, I'm gonna have a video game vacation. I was like, I'm going to play The Last of Us Part 2. Oh, I forgot. Duh. In March, when the pandemic started, then I finished The Last of Us Part 1, right? So that matters. And I was like, my friend let me borrow his PS4 and I was like, he had the game and I was like, oh, fuck it. So I played it and I finished it in March. So I was really anticipating being able to play The Last of Us Part 2. So, and then I think the timing with the pandemic and everything like that, and, you know, this infection that's spreading and whatnot. And we're probably talking about the film Contagion around the same time. So, you know, like, there's all of these like kind of coalescing factors. And anyway, I end up getting to play The Last of Us Part 2 and I fucking loved it. I absolutely loved it. And I don't know what all the controversy is about. I've listened to some of it, like some people who didn't want to play as this person that they come to despise. And then precisely like Evan said, they didn't want to mash the square button. Ironically, I think most people just kind of like side with the Ellie desire to not hurt Abby and they want to actually – I'm sorry, the Abby side to not want to hurt Ellie, but they want to hurt Abby. Whereas I actually think that that's what makes the game so potent and so interesting, is that it forces you to get out of your comfort zone. It subverts your expectations and it forces you to kind of like create these empathic connections with characters that you might not want to. And I think that's what makes the series so amazing in general, which we can talk about more. But this game in particular, I thought was so fascinating from that perspective. Beyond the fact that the gameplay is amazing. When the game first fucking started and you're on that horse with Joel and you come up over the ridge and you look at the city, like I literally... Maybe I was a little high. I don't know what the deal was. But I was like, bro, I got to move to like fucking Jackson Hole, Wyoming or something like that. You know, I was like, that's it. Like, I got to get a horse and get to a place. It was the most gorgeous opening. And I just immediately, I had chills all over my body. I was like, this is it, man. So the gameplay was amazing. The visuals were amazing. I thought the story was really intriguing. I fucking loved it.
Cool. I played the first game 4 times.
Oh,
I was so in love. I mean, since it came out in, what, 2013 or something like that, I think I played it once, played it immediately again on New Game Plus, and then over the next couple of years, I found myself returning to it. And then once, the last time I played it, the fourth time I played it, I actually played it for my mom because I wanted my mom to understand. And my mom actually ended up developing a crush on Joel and getting really, really into the story. So I love the first one. When the second one came out, I didn't read. I saw on Metacritic that it was having a very divisive response from the fans, but I didn't really read into the details because I wanted to experience it, you know, without having it being ruined. And here's the thing. With this game, my main question is, do these very deliberate choices by Druckmann create an avant-garde experience, or is it a risk that didn't pay off? Because I think there are a lot of things in this game that... are huge, bold choices that, I mean, you know, Abby obviously being one of them, that I suspect, because Druckmann also wrote the last Uncharted game, at least that's like the only one I've played in recent years. He's clearly a seasoned writer who doesn't make rookie mistakes. So I think he threw a lot of conventional writing rules out the window with this game and to make something that's very avant-garde. And I'm hoping that by the end of this podcast, we can kind of suss out whether it is an avant-garde achievement or if it's just a risk that didn't quite land. But without further ado, let's get into a recap. So after Joel is brutally murdered by a woman named Abby, Ellie and her lover Dina set off on a quest to seek vengeance on Abby and her crew. Along with Jesse, the father to Dina's unborn child, and Tommy, Joel's brother, Ellie and her crew hunt down the majority of Abby's crew. After 4 days of hunting, they're unable to find Abby. At the end of the fourth day, when the whole team is reunited, Abby shows up, kills Jesse, and holds Ellie at gunpoint. At this point, the game rewinds 4 days to the beginning of Ellie's revenge trip to Seattle, instead told from the point of view of Abby. We learn that Abby's father was the lead doctor who was killed by Joel at the end of the first game, and that is her motivation for killing Joel. Abby's militant society is about to commit a genocide on a neighboring group of religious zealots known as Seraphites. On her way to reach her recently excommunicated ex-boyfriend Owen, she befriends two Seraphites, one of which is a transgender boy named Lev who is being hunted by his people. Abby helps nurse the Seraphites back to health. When Lev travels back to the Seraphite island to see his mother, Abby is forced to rescue him in the midst of her people's invasion. With both Abby's people and Lev's people trying to kill the duo, they escape the war-torn island, only to discover that Ellie has killed Owen and his lover. Now back at the end of day 4, Abby defeats Ellie and on Lev's request spares her and Dina, telling them she never wants to see them again. Sometime later, Dina and Ellie are settled on a ranch raising Jesse's child, but Ellie is still struck by nightmares of Joel's brutal death. When Tommy comes by with information on Abby's whereabouts, Ellie heads off to finish what she started. Meanwhile, Abby and Lev are trying to reconnect with the Fireflies in Santa Barbara, but get captured by a slave-owning society. Abby and Lev are enslaved, and when they try to escape, are crucified. Ellie infiltrates the area, frees Abby, and gets within an inch of killing her before withdrawing and letting her and Lev go. The game ends with Ellie returning to an empty ranch, playing the guitar that Joel gave to her. End of game. Alright guys, before we continue, I want to give a shout out to Storyblocks for sponsoring this episode. Storyblocks is the complete stock solution for creators and businesses who need to license assets. With an unlimited plan, you can receive access to thousands of photos, videos, audio clips, and project templates. Licensing a standalone video or music track can be quite expensive and sometimes more than your budget allows. With Storyblocks, you can download, test, and use any clips you need, all for the subscription price. It's great because once you download an asset, it's yours to keep forever, regardless of your subscription status. Storyblocks is constantly updating their library, so there are always new assets to use. Find out more about Storyblocks subscriptions by going to storyblocks.com/wisecrack, link in the show notes. And now back to the show. All right, guys, so I wanted to start off talking about what I think is maybe one of the most radical elements of this story, which is the structure. I mean, normally with a story with multiple perspectives over a single period of time, they'll unfold simultaneously, we'll cut between characters. But this does something pretty radical when it tells half a story and then a full stop at the seeming climax, then brings us all the way back in time to the beginning to tell from the other perspective. I mean, you can imagine something like a Christopher Nolan movie, which is constantly has these parallel timelines that are cutting back and forth between. That might have been something that I think a more traditional story might do if you are going to do things from two different characters' perspectives. But do you think that this choice helps communicate the game's message about empathy and the destructive nature of revenge, or does it just kill the story's momentum?
Evan, what do you think?
I definitely think it hurts the momentum for sure. I personally remember getting to that part when you switched to Abby, and I kind of felt like it was coming. I hadn't read anything about it, but just based off the choices of what happened in the beginning and just like I had like a hunch. I was like, at some point I'm going to return to Abby and I know this is going to happen. So as you walk through like the wolf, headquarters in the stadium, I was like, man, I feel like I know exactly where this is going to go. Her story is going to mirror Ellie's. Like, we're going to see all the same beats. We're going to see the community. We're going to see all these people. And even thinking that, I was still surprised at how affected I was when I saw characters pop up again. Like, you know, the dog you have to kill as Ellie in the climactic moment I was like, oh, all right, here we go. All of Abby's random companions. But it still does stick out to me in a way where I think back about this game and I appreciate what, you know, Neil Druckmann's doing. And I'm just not sure if, personally, I can't think of another way to structure the game to get the same point across that wouldn't have stalled the momentum.
Yeah, I almost wonder if part of the divide, and you know, you'd have to do like some sort of fucking case study on this to figure it out, but if part of the divide is that empaths respond to this game in one way and people who are less kind of inclined towards a deep empathy would respond in another way. I don't know which way that would be necessarily. And then of course, probably even empaths would respond differently, but that it's about certain like proclivities and inclinations and things like that. But there's something for me, I do think I'm quite empathic. And for me, I, again, like Evan, I anticipated that there would be a return to Abby, but I was already kind of connected to Abby. And I was connected in a way where I was, one, kind of, I think there's a very subtle sense because you're still learning the gameplay controls through Abby, right? You learn to run and jump through Abby, which I thought was quite an interesting move because then that's almost like the elementary rules of the gameplay. It's like you're taking baby steps with Abby. So there's almost like a germinal connection that the game forces you to make with her at the beginning. And then you get that little bit of her, like, having her fear of heights when she's walking around the ledge, right? And so you're like, oh, okay. So immediately, again, there's like a sense where you're aligning with her fears. So I was already kind of in it with her. And then you're like, this fucking horrible human just kills Joel. And then you're like mad at Neil Druckmann. You're like, damn it, Druckmann. Why did you make me start to like actually control this person? Because you're like invested in her getting saved by Joel. Remember that one point? You're like invested in them saving her. So then you're like even emotionally invested in her being saved. Even in the back of your mind, you might be thinking already that there's something ominous going on. It doesn't matter. You're like already being emotionally manipulated to care about this character. And then you find out, and then she fucking kills Joel. And you're like, this is, okay, that's it. I fucking hate you. But for me, it wasn't like I hate you, I hate this game, because I like having my expectations fucked with, right? Like, I like that discomfort. A lot of people don't. And so I can understand why that would affect them negatively, whereas for someone like me, I'm kind of like, oh, this is intriguing. Okay, let's see where this goes, right? And I think I just kind of had trust in the storytellers that it would lead to something interesting because the first game was so interesting, right? So for me, yeah, there is a break in the momentum, but there's also a kind of a moment to make new connections. And so for me, I did feel a little bit of like a break, but I also felt a little bit of like a reprieve because the game is so intense and it's so there's so much momentum that when that shift comes, when you switch from Ellie to Abby and then you get that like 10-hour extended play with Abby, at that moment where it starts, you're almost like you get a little bit of a break. And then you kind of start over again, and then you create like a parallel stream of momentum, and then it's almost like a tangent where the two kind of are coming together, and do they ever converge, and do they ever converge, and then finally they do converge at the end, right? So for me, yeah, it's a break in the momentum, but I think it's also an opportunity for a reprieve, one, from the Ellie storyline, the Ellie-Joel storyline, we might call it, and then two, there's like a point for new connections to be made productively through that. So for me, I kind of, that's why I really enjoyed it, but I totally can understand why somebody would be like, nah, dude, you're a fucking idiot, this fucking sucked, it killed the momentum. I totally get that too. I wonder if it's just different personality types, you know?
The one thing I will say that I think the this kind of untraditional structure achieves is that, you know, as Ellie, you find yourself doing things like killing Abby's friends, killing the dog. I mean, the dog is one that really stuck with me. But then if it were a story that was told in a parallel manner, you know, we would see the dog and then, you know, we would know that, oh, we're probably going to be going back to Ellie and probably kill the dog. But it's interesting that you kill the dog and then they make you play fetch with the dog like hours later. So, you know, the game almost trains you to hate yourself in a sense. Like it seduces you into this revenge story in which the way that these stories function is you identify with the protagonist, you identify with their lust for revenge and you feel that seething lust as well. And then it is an interesting thing that, like, you know, you then get to see the perspective of, you know, the consequences of all of your revenge through a very just painful, deliberately slow troll almost. I mean, you know, like it really is a painful experience to play that second half of the game because you identify with pretty much, at least I did, I identified with all of the choices that Ellie was making and generally cheered her on. And then to have that complicated in such an emotionally manipulative way, you know, it is kind of like, fuck you, Druckmann. This is not, how dare you make me watch this.
Right.
But at the same time, I mean, it is something unique.
This is what's the genius of the game, though, right? Like, not only are you watching the unfolding of the cycle of violence and the consequences, you become complicit, right? Like, you are part of both sides of this cycle. And you could even say, like, okay, let's connect it to the first game. You've got the Fireflies, and are they good or are they bad? Well, we're told that they're bad because we're on the other side. And we didn't have a choice which side. We were, like, thrown into – we're, like, born into Joel's daughter first, and then Joel's storyline, and then Ellie's storyline. So we're kind of like told that that's the good side and that the Fireflies are the bad side. But the Fireflies are maybe kind of trying to fight for a cure, right? Whether or not it would have been successful, we don't know. So Joel's decision at the end is viewed as complicated, but we kind of understand it because of his empathy and his love now for Ellie, which is great because that resolves all of his daddy issue or his issues like with his daughter, and he's learning how to open up again, and you know, and all this other stuff that comes along with that, right? But we're also kind of like, oh, okay, is this the just decision? Did he make a selfish decision or did he make the right decision? And so this game starts where we're already in that complicated set of consequences from that decision. You know, when he's talking with his brother and his brother's like, fuck man, can't believe you made that decision, right? So, and then Ellie's mad at him, and then that adds other layers to this as well. So we're already like, did he make the right decision or did he make a bad decision because it was a selfish decision, right? And you kind of have to just live with these consequences and maybe even suspend your rush to make that judgment about what's right and what's wrong and the good and the bad. And you kind of are just forced to kind of just accept and then to empathize. And I think that is what makes this so sticky and what makes it so difficult and what makes it so complicated.
Right. Yeah. I was reading some of the articles over at Polygon by Chris Plant and Maddie Myers about the game. And one thing that hadn't really stuck out to me was, what if you like the game, but you really didn't like, what if you like Last of Us 1, but you didn't really like Joel's decision at the end? And now you're stuck playing with the aftermath of that decision. And I wonder how that experience would have affected, or what someone who would have, who felt like that would have felt like playing through this game as well. Just because I just feel like there is, I feel like choice, right? Obviously such a big thing in this, a theme in this game in general. And I think like just the lack of, you know, maybe agency, like being forced to be complicit in something, I think right. is very interesting, you know? Yeah.
Yeah. Like, would you, if you didn't like the end of The Last of Us, would you then be like, yeah, Abby's in the right because Joel made a fucked up decision. And he's dealing with the consequences of unnecessarily murdering a doctor. It wasn't like he was killing a military personnel or an infected. This was a doctor who was most likely, for all intents and purposes, trying to find a cure for humanity. Whereas you can kind of justify it away and be like, yeah, but he's a Firefly and the Fireflies are the baddies. And then, of course, that's the easy answer, right? But the more complicated answer is what if you just didn't agree with it? And then now you're kind of like, yeah, I get Abby's decision. So it kind of forces you to kind of question yourself. Go ahead. Yeah.
I think, yeah, the sin of both the doctor and Joel is that nobody really ever questioned whether they should let Ellie make the decision, at least, you know, whether she wants to live or die. And yeah, I was kind of, and I did appreciate how we did get the Firefly leader. We saw that character again, and we saw that even she was very tortured by this decision to kill Ellie. And so it even humanizes somebody who, once again, we relished killing at the end of the first game. I mean, I feel like if you didn't like Joel's decision at the end, you'd probably like this game because the whole game is just the series of tragic dominoes falling because of Joel's decision.
Yeah. Yeah, and isn't it just kind of enough to maybe even say, I liked it and I didn't like it? Like, I liked yeah. his decision because you care for Ellie and you're like, fuck, man. And it's so good for his story arc and it makes sense and you get it. But at the same time, if it's true that she could have been a cure, is there some sort of like utilitarian logic that would have said that, man, maybe it would have been good to sacrifice her for the greater good? And this is the problem with ethics, that this shit is sticky. And I think that anyone who just easily is like, nah, it's either this or that, is really doing a disservice to the rational and kind of critical faculties that we could explore and that clearly Druckmann is like prodding us to explore.
Yeah. No, this is, I mean, I'm amazed that this got made in the way that it did. That's what makes video games so exciting, that something that breaks this many conventional rules and is this much of a potential spit in the face to half of your fan base gets made and has so much money behind it and really talented creative teams spend years making to fulfill one man's avant-garde vision is pretty special whether you hate it or not.
So you said, is it a risk that doesn't pay off? What
yeah.
What are you wondering about there?
Okay, so I've heard some people say that, you know, at right after you finish Abby's half of the game, you return to the climax, you're inside the theater, and you start fighting Ellie as Abby. And I've heard a lot of people say that when they first started that fight, they deliberately tried to have Abby die to see if that changed the story. You know, if maybe that there was some sort of choice you have in this section. If you let Ellie win, then, you know, maybe this story branches down one path. And if you win as Abby, maybe it does another. But it's you basically have to win as Abby. And a lot of people have said that it's a proof. It's proof that Druckmann failed if you try to have Ellie win, because in having this fight where you play as Abby, people have said, and this is part of one of the controversies, is that your allegiances should have switched from Ellie to Abby after finishing Abby's quest. And if you still want Ellie to win, which I'm not going to lie, I'm one of these people who tried to just have Abby die, does that make the game a failure?
Oh no, I think that's such an oversimplification. That is such an oversimplification. I think that totally misses out on the complexity and depth of what it means to be human. We're problematic and we're confused and we have layers, and it isn't just either allegiance on one side or allegiance on another side. Like, come on, man, what is this, a fucking Western where it's the black hat and the white hat? Come on, it's layers of intensity. You might even be like, oh, fuck, okay, fuck this Abby chick. Like, yeah, I've been playing with her. I get it, but she's still ultimately fucking Abby, and I'm still ultimately on the side of Ellie. But I still feel, like, I think that's a sign of the success of the game, that you're kind of like, ah, fuck you, game. I'm going to try to, like, I'm going to actually let Ellie win because I'm still on her side. And the game is like, no, guess what? We're still going to force you to actually try to win from this vantage that makes you uncomfortable. And that's because the game...
I agree that it makes you think, and I agree that it's uncomfortable, and I agree that it's powerful, but there is something binary about the nature of gaming in that, you know, in a film or something like that, you know, you can maybe film something from multiple perspectives or film in, like, a more objective manner as to not prioritize the perspective of one character over another. But in this one, you're not just watching Abby fight Ellie, and you're not just like, oh man, I can't decide who wins, or maybe I want one character to win. The game makes a stance by making you play as Abby, at least in that scene, I think. So, I mean, I'm just saying that I think that you're right, but because this is a video game in which you control an avatar, and you project yourself onto that avatar, and in order for gaming in this kind of tradition to work, you have to empathize with that avatar in order for that emotional connection to take place. There is something perhaps lost if you're not connecting with the avatar that you're being told that you have to play as. Having said that, I understand how complicated it is and how that can really be something that leads to critical thought. But in terms of an emotionally engaging narrative experience, does it harm the final product? You know, it's almost like, as critics, as people who like to break down story and be critical of media like we are, it seems like, you know, the perfect game in a sense, because there's all these interesting things that it's taking. But if you're just a consumer who wants to be taken away and thrust into an amazing story, it's kind of working counter to that.
Yeah, one thing that just popped into my mind, like, that maybe would have been more of a troll, so to speak, is if they let you choose who to play as in that fight and you still lose anyway, you know, like, no matter what the outcome is, like, someone comes in, if it's Dina or if it's Levs telling someone to stop, right? Like, that would have been cool.
Do we really think, though, that the writers thought that a large percentage of people would want Abby to win? No. They know. They're not foolish. They know that we have already built up years of attachment to Ellie. I mean, Ellie is a signal of, like, feminine power, right? She's also just a fucking bat. Like, I left the first game and I was like, dude, she's a fucking superhero, right? Like, I want an Ellie doll, right? Like she's such so cool. So you are so bought into Ellie. There's no way that a 10-hour excursion is going to flip your allegiance, especially when she kills Joel even if you feel like, okay, there's justification from her perspective, there's no way that Druckmann is going to be like, ah, let's see how many converts we can get to the Abbey side, and then this final culmination, this battle here, is really going to fuck with them from that angle. No, no, no. I think he's clearly trying to just subvert expectations. And this is the thing that I think is so interesting. Like, so often when we consume a piece of media, and I don't know, you call it a troll, and maybe this is a troll, but so often we consume media, we judge it based on whether or not it fits with our expectations or not, especially in the age of, like, personalization, right? Everything we get is just whether or not it fits within the boxes that we've already, whether it's fucking dating online through the apps or whether it's fucking consuming YouTube videos, the algorithms are all just giving us what we want, more of what we want. We never encounter the other. Right? And this is something that I've talked about on the podcast before with the philosophy of Byung-Chul Han, who Byung-Chul Han talks about how the kind of logic of late neoliberalism is a logic of what he calls pure positivity, where there is no encounter with the other. There's no encounter with negativity. There's no encounter that makes us uncomfortable, but rather we're just constantly fed more of you. And so it becomes a purely like narcissistic endeavor. And so I wonder if so much of our consumption of media is narcissistic because we want it to just fit with our expectations. And then Druckmann here is saying, ah, I know you have all these expectations. The history of gaming kind of teaches us that these are our expectations, but I'm intentionally going to play with that because I view The Last of Us Part II less as a game and more as just a form of narrative storytelling that we happen to be participating in. And if you want to call it a game, you can, but in like an anthropological term, we could call it like a form of deep play. You know, about how we're like engaging in society and learning about ourselves and learning about all those things. And so for me, the success or lack of success isn't about does it fit within the history of kind of gaming expectations, but does it fit within the kind of more narrow field of what we think maybe Druckmann was trying to do. And I think he clearly was aware that nobody would be rooting for Abby to win at that point.
See, I mean, I hear your argument. I think that he was going for at least the view or the viewer or the gamer to be conflicted about it.
You do.
Or to not know what they want. Interesting. Yeah, what do you think, Evan?
Yeah, I mean I think I agree with like both points there. I definitely think like people definitely should have felt conflicted. But I do think what you're saying, Austin, like, yeah, viewing it as less of a game and just more of like, yeah, deep play, so to speak, definitely resonates well with me. As someone who definitely was almost converted to the Abby side by that point, you know, especially after seeing how much she had gone through, like, with the wolves and the Seraphites, like, I definitely just admire just the, I guess, the tenacity, so to speak.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, what I think some gamers find so sadistic about this is very essential to the nature of gaming itself, because Evan brought up choice, and a lot of gaming is giving you this illusion of choice. Like, yes, you can choose to equip the shotgun or equip the handgun, or you can choose any which way to kill everybody or to just avoid them. But at the end of the day, it's still a relatively narrow path that you have to tread, and the game is punishing you for these choices, these quote-unquote choices that you are fooled into thinking that you can make. Like, you think that you can make the choice to kill the dog, and then you do kill the dog, and then, you know, but that's kind of, the game is holding your hand through that decision with that invisible hand, and then when you go later in the game and play with the dog, you really regret that decision. But there's a weird phenomenon in which the game is making you feel guilty as a choice that you've made as a player, but really that choice is dictated to you by the mechanics of the game, which calls, of course, to the famous Bioshock quote at the end. What is it? A man chooses, a slave obeys.
Mm. It reminds me, remember when we watched Bandersnatch and we talked about this as well? And it was kind of like, oh, you think you have a choice, but actually it's ultimately kind of leading you. And there's a couple of choices where it's like that choice just keeps taking you back and to force you to make the other choice, right? There was the one, I can't remember, he's in like his boss's office and it has to do with like the video game or whatever. I can't remember. And it was like you keep getting forced to have to make the one choice. And it happens a couple of times, right? Go ahead.
There's actually there's a interesting app or platform called What If I. It's like a mobile app, but I thought it was one of those like choose your own adventure storyline type deals, but it actually is like branching narratives. So there, like every choice you make will never bring you back around and will continue going and going. And they're like these like 16 to 20 minute short films that are truly like everyone. I've like looked at like the scripts and stuff like that are all independent choices. So what was interesting is like you never feel like you have to, like, did I ever make the right choice or the wrong choice? You always made a choice and you're going to stick with it. And then the creators are going to satisfy or deliver on that decision. And I do wonder with a game like Last of Us 2, if more of that choice and if was given to the player with, you know, different separate consequences, like how would that have affected, you know, people's reactions to it, or how would it have affected the storyline in general? Because like we've talked about, it does seem like Neil Druckmann is like, by not providing those choices, he's taking a stance, right, on what he wants you to get out of this, whether it's, you know, more of like Jared, your interpretation, or Austin, your interpretation of it. He's definitely making a stand of saying like, there's something I want you to experience here.
Yeah. Right. What do we think he is trying to make us experience?
I think he's trying to make you feel the really horrible consequences of violent acts and how these things, ripple through, they have consequences that continue to go deeper and deeper into catastrophe. And I think he's ultimately making a point about, I mean, I don't want to use the cheesy phrase of like, you know, your enemy is just somebody whose shoes you haven't walked in yet or whatever, but something like that.
Yeah. I mean, that's a statement about empathy. Right. And, so we're actually working on a video, where we're going to flesh this out hopefully. But one of the things is, so in cognitive science, they make a distinction between empathy and then something called emotional contagion. And then there's a book by a psychologist that's called Against Empathy. Bloom wrote this in like 2016 or something like that. Or maybe it was earlier than that even. Where he actually argues against empathy. And so Matthew Ricard he's known as like the happiest man on earth. He's a monk now, but he used to be a neuroscientist. I don't know if you guys know who he is. He's a French monk, whatever. But one of the things he talks about is that emotional contagion is basically where you lose yourself in another person, right? You completely like have lost because you're completely identified in the other person. And so Bloom kind of runs with this idea of emotional contagion and says, well, this is one of the consequences that potentially comes from empathy, is you lose your rational capacity to actually think about whether or not you should align with this other person, right? And so he says that that's why empathy is actually an insufficient form of like ethics. It's an insufficient mode of building an ethical system on, right? And one of the things that we are so inundated with now is empathy. I mean, reality television operates well because there's a sense in which we empathize. VR experiences are all about stimulating empathy. Like literally they're even doing that intentionally politically, where you can go to like sub-Saharan Africa and hang out in a village so you can literally empathize with somebody that's not you, so you can encounter the other, so to speak, right? So there's this like we're immersed in a culture of empathy, and the question is that sufficient as an ethical system to kind of like build human activities or societies upon, or is there a limitation? And I think this game kind of in some ways shows you the consequences of just relying on empathy and how difficult it is to be just purely empathic all the time, or how difficult it is to just stay in that mode of empathizing, because you do get tossed to and fro. I can see Abby's perspective. I can see Ellie's perspective. Oh no, I fucking hate Abby because I've already empathized with this other storyline, you know, and you're kind of like tossed back and forth. And empathy then kind of becomes an interesting mode to connect, but is it a sufficient mode for social connection if we're going to build like political systems and ethical systems and determine choice and behavior and things like that? And that's what I think is so interesting, is kind of like navigating through the messiness of empathy and kind of ethics and things like that.
Yeah. Before we go any further, got to give a shout out to our sponsors over at Skillshare. So it's been 6 months and we're all still stuck inside. One thing you can do to keep your mind limber and keep yourself from going insane is to learn some new skills, and that's where Skillshare comes in. If you're looking to explore new skills or get inspired or deepen your existing passions, Skillshare is an online learning community where you can explore and discover thousands of classes on a wide variety of topics like graphic design, productivity, creative writing, film and video, freelancing, and more. And I want to emphasize the community aspect because during quarantine, finding a group of people who share the same interest as you can be really rewarding. Because it's really hard to do in real life right now. So if you're looking for a class to take, in the past I've recommended iPhone filmmaking, creative cinematic video on your iPhone, creative nonfiction, Write Truth with Style with Susan Orlean, but today I want to plug a new class, Filmmaking from Home, How to Turn Found Footage into a Compelling Video, taught by Penny Lane. Penny is a nonfiction filmmaker. Her most recent doc was Hail Satan, which I believe is on some streaming services right now. She'll teach you how to take found footage and edit it into something compelling. When you compare Skillshare to expensive in-person workshops or night classes, it is quite affordable. An annual subscription is less than 10 bucks a month, and right now they're offering Show Me the Meaning listeners 2 free months. All you got to do is go to skillshare.com/wisecrack. Again, that's skillshare.com/wisecrack for 2 free months of unlimited access to awesome classes. And now back to the show. So if I did want to talk about some little minor things that bother me about this. I wanted to get your thoughts on it, because aside from the Abby thing, aside from the Joel thing, there are a couple things that the game has been criticized for that I think hold some water. And one of them is Tommy. I actually think I would have rather played the way that the story unfolds, especially Ellie's half. I mean, if you notice for my recap of the game, I spent very little time talking about Ellie's story because not a lot happens. She's almost always finding out. She's always like one step behind Tommy. And it almost would have been more interesting to play as Tommy, because he's the one. It's just such a strange choice to have your protagonist just finding the breadcrumbs of a different character rather than, you know, driving the action forward and being the main motivator of the revenge. Don't you guys think that's weird?
Yeah, in some of the reading yesterday, one of the things that, like, didn't click with me was the fact that I think, you know, as you see these, like you said, Jared, not a lot happens to Ellie, but, like, most of the bulk of her story is these flashbacks, right? Her discovering, you know, the lie that Joel told her over the years and coming to terms with it. But remember, like, by the time that she set out on that journey, she's already come full circle and, like, accepted what Joel has done to her and is trying to be better about it. And so I think the thing about what makes it interesting to have, you know, not a lot happen in Ellie's storyline is to understand that, oh, she's already, like, she was already, like, sealed her fate, like, down this path of revenge the whole time. She was ready to, like, do whatever it took because she, it didn't matter, you know, Dina was really the one discovering at this point, like, who, you know, what Joel actually did, I guess. Because she knows exactly who they are and she's ready to fully exact revenge on these people that at one point were the purpose of her life.
Yeah, the only problem for some, I guess I would say, for me, I love it, but that's just because I fucking love everything, and I don't have like a mean bone in my body, so when I play these things, I'm like, yes, just give it to me, I'll accept it, and I'll figure out how to make it good by the end, right? You only get that at the end, though. You only find out that there's like a retroactive justification, which for me was so impactful, because then I stopped, and I was like, oh, fuck. So then I'm like revisiting, what did I just come through for the last 20 hours? And because I did it over such a short, like, condensed period of time, too, I was, like, so immersed, right? So for me, like, the beginning of the game was still very, very, very fresh in my mind, because it felt like it was just one event. So for me, it was really easy to kind of, like, then revisit all the stuff I had just gone through and be like, oh, now that changes it, because now she's already on the path of reconciliation, which then makes Joel's death even more painful. Because then you're like, oh, fuck, they have this severing, but no, they were just starting to mend, and they had this lovely conversation just the night before. And you're like, fuck, okay, again, there's that bond, harmony. And then, of course, then it's even more impactful that harmony broke, which, again, is like, fuck you, Druckmann, that's just mean, you know? Like, you make me care even more, and then you fucking kick me in the balls. But yes, I do agree with you, Jared. I don't feel that connection with Tommy. And I never felt that connection with Tommy. And if we just got a couple hours maybe of gameplay, like scouting with Tommy, that would have probably helped me to care a little bit more about Tommy. Maybe you see a little bit more about Tommy's like sadness over his brother or his anger. Maybe that would have been a good way, because there's not a lot of, I mean, I guess you do get the anger, but just maybe like pure vengeance and rage. Maybe that would have been interesting, you know?
I think we needed to see a lot of that, because the first time we see Tommy, he's acting as a mouthpiece for his wife, who's telling him not to seek vengeance. And then instead of actually seeing him undergo a transformation in which he realizes that not only is my wife wrong, but I need to travel, what is it, hundreds, thousands of miles to defy my wife and seek vengeance. I would have liked to see a little bit more of that transformation. And then this goes also with the end when Tommy comes back and tells Ellie that you need to go find Abby, and he's still so consumed with the vengeance. It just seemed like a bit of a lot of change of character that seemed a little bit out of left field for me.
I don't know, but what if that's part of it, right? Like, what if that's part of, like, revenge can make, you know, loss can make someone just flip like that? Because in the first game, even Tommy is presented as someone, you know, him and Joel have always, it's always been said that they've done, like, a lot of shady things before they, you know, split ways and, like, found their own lives, like Joel in Boston and Tommy in Jackson. And you see Tommy as this guy who is, like, he's almost, like, trying. I feel like there are a handful of characters that are resemblance are like trying to uphold whatever's left of like the society before. And I feel like Tommy is kind of part of that, right? And starting Jackson and you know, getting the power back and all that stuff. And so I think to see him come this full circle to back to his roots now because the loss of his brother, and to see how a character that we have, you know, from afar admired, like I will say you're right, there isn't like that much connection, but from afar we've admired him. To now like be in the same kind of like well that Ellie is, I thought it was very interesting. I thought it really impacted me when seeing Tommy so broken in Ellie's house and being like, they're in Santa Barbara, we can get them. Like I can do it if you're not gonna do it. And you know, he's got his one eye and everything, and even like and that's like just heal. You know, you're just moments after, or at least in the timeline, moments after, just like they were in the theater and he was like, I hope Maria likes this gold watch, I'm not sure if she's gonna like it, you know, but I'm bringing it back for her to like say sorry. So yeah,
one other thing I want to touch on before we go into the mailbag is, because we haven't really talked about the specifics of Abby's story, and do you guys, I mean, I've played the game twice now, and the second time I played with infinite ammo, which I definitely recommend. But do you guys buy that Abby would go from a Seraphite killing machine to risking her own life to make sure that two of them reach safety? Because I've heard some criticisms that, again, I think hold some water, that it feels like a forced element of the game's mission to explore, again, empathy, which is the main theme of the game that we've talked about.
I kind of agree with that note. I as much as I liked the characters of Yara and Lev, I did feel like the Seraphite story, as much as I want to know more about that world, did feel like not shoehorned, but in a way that I was like, maybe it's part of the momentum thing, right? Maybe I was like, come on, get back to it. Where's Ellie? But I was not so impacted by that, and I didn't really buy Abby's switching over, because like it to us it seems like all she needed to hear was that Owen saved one of them, and that she's like, oh, if Owen did it, I guess I can kind of do it as long as no one finds out. And then
she's, you know, willing to kill all of her friends.
Exactly. Yeah, so that was a little,
yeah, what do we think's going on there? Why just accepting the story without being critical for a second, why does she all of a sudden switch? There has to be some sort of reason. It's not just simply because they saved her, right? There's something that's kind of been brewing, maybe. And see, for me, it kind of, I thought that there was, there starts to become a dissatisfaction with the mission of the wolves, right? Is that what she's,
yeah, cause,
or not the wolves.
Yeah, because Jeffrey Wright's character is about to impart on a genocide.
Yeah.
And I wish they had explored a little bit more of how she breaks with him ideologically, because we don't really see any of that. We see her saying, all right, well, I'm going to rebel and go find Owen because I love Owen, rather than, man, what is the Jeffrey Wright's character's name? I can't remember.
Yeah, I can't remember either.
Yeah. Isaac, yeah. It's, instead of, like, fuck Isaac, we're not going to commit a fucking genocide on that island.
And here's the question. Was – and this, I think, goes to the issue of empathy in society too. Was she more involved with the cause of this military society, or was she just kind of more involved because she was raised by her father and the Fireflies, and then this new community just so happened to be there kind of almost incidentally, but that really her connection was with one father and then two Owen, and then she makes those individual connections. But like the grand vision, the mission, the ideology isn't something that necessarily she fully bought on board or was on board with. Do you know what I mean? So rather than...
Yeah, totally. I there's a couple parts during the flashbacks where Abby's like, all right, come on, let's go back to training. We can still make it back for training. And I get the feeling that she joined this militaristic society just to gain the crew and the training to take down Joel. And that's another thing I wish that we had seen a little bit more of, is just how the vengeance consumed her. Mm. Actually, we do get actually a nice part where I think Owen and her are in the aquarium for the first time, and Owen tries to like make out with her or something, and she says, stop, I can't do it. And Owen's like, what's wrong? And she says, Joel's still out there. Like, and Owen just sighs like, oh my God, this again. So I think it's kind of it was a smart writing move to show that like this girl is so consumed by revenge that she can't even have sex without thinking about the guy who killed her father. Having said that, I still think that it would be interesting to see how after she got the revenge, how she's aimless and how she doesn't really she has a hard time connecting with the mission of this militaristic society now that her real main mission has been achieved.
Yeah, one thing that I'm actually not sure if it was in the game because I didn't remember this, but I was watching snippets of a Laura Bailey interview, and apparently Jeffrey Wright's character Isaac is supposed to be, he was a former Firefly from Salt Lake City. I don't know if they say that in the game, but I think that is supposed to be the connection, that he kind of like bought them or brought them there, or they reconnected with him or something like that. And I think, you know, it goes kind of hand in hand. Like if you can see that there's remnants of Firefly, maybe that's, you know, what you do, you know, you leap into, I guess. Yeah.
Real quick, I know we're running long and we got to get into the mailbag, but do we think there's going to be a third? And if so, what would we like to see? Speaking about expectations.
I was just going to say maybe there's going to be like a DLC content or like mini game like there was for Last of Us 1 about Joel and Tommy potentially, you know, or another another like prequel type thing. But a third one, I don't know. I think there might, it's hard to say where they would go with it. I don't know if Ellie would be the main character if there was a third one.
Oh, that would be such a shame.
And it would be a huge risk.
I want more Ellie. It would be a shame if they didn't make a third one. I mean, I think that despite the critical division, I think the game was still financially successful. What would I like to see? Do you have an answer, Oscar?
Have a think about that. I was going to say, even though there was criticism, do you get a lot of people, like, you can criticize something and you say, this is a piece of garbage, I won't play it. Or do you think that most people are like, fuck, it was annoying, but there's still some kind of emotional attachment, which is kind of fucked up.
No, you don't understand gamer rancor. I mean, they're like 100% fuck this, burn it to the ground. There's actually, in the Last of Us 2 subreddit I read yesterday, they're actually trying to sue Neil Druckmann or get him fired for false advertising. Because I don't know if you know this, Austin, but there's, in one of the earlier trailers, they created a cinematic of Joel telling Ellie, you think I'd let you do this alone? And that line is actually said in the game by Jesse when she finds out that Jesse's traveled all this way to join them. And so there was a little bit of like deliberate misinformation from Neil Druckmann, which to me is relatively harmless, but people are really freaking out about it.
Yeah, but it's funny because you don't even see him say that line in the cinematic, right?
I think you do in the cinematic, but that cinematic is nowhere in the game. They just made it for the trailer.
Yeah, she's like playing guitar in a bed, right? That one?
Something like that, yeah.
Well, even if there is like this hard line division and people are like, fuck this, burn it to the ground, I have hope for humans that we can be flexible and malleable and that our brains are plastic and that even in that anger and on those subreddit boards, that when they lay their head down at night, they're still dealing with the messiness and the complexity of things and that they'll come out stronger on the other side. I have hope. I'm an educator, so I'm always excited about that. But in terms of a third one, yeah, I hope we get a third one. Like, I can't even describe the experience that I had playing this game over the 2 days. It was what I needed. I was just burned out. It was in between terms. I'm working on, like, too much stuff. And it was just what I needed. And I spent 2 full days in this. And then I played Uncharted. I played Uncharted 4. Then I played Uncharted 3. And then I played God of War, the new God of War. This was my holiday. I did all four of those in 10 days. Okay? So, like,
it's beautiful.
My body wasted away over those 10 days because all I did was sit in my beanbag chair and fucking play games and eat Domino's pizza or whatever else. I was like fucking, remember in Zombieland, Jesse Eisenberg, when he doesn't even know that a fucking zombie apocalypse has happened because he's got a leaning tower of pizza boxes and fucking drinking Mountain Dew Code Red or whatever.
I was just gonna ask if you were drinking Mountain
Dew
Code
Red. That was fucking me, bro. I wasn't drinking it, but metaphorically, that was my spirit animal for that time. So it was like I needed it, and it was such a wonderful experience for me. And because I'm not the kind of like either burn it to the ground or like this is the greatest thing ever type of person, and I enjoy kind of like waffling back and forth between everything. For me, it was just the perfect experience. It was like therapy for me during the Rona lockdown.
Yeah. Very cool. Yeah, I can't really. It's a difficult prompt to ask me what I would do, what I'd like to see with the third game. So I think I'm gonna have to put a little more thought into that before I answer.
Yeah. Well, how about you out there? Email us and let us know.
Yeah. Email us. What would you like to see from the third game? And with that, we're gonna go into the mailbag. So you can send us some voicemails at 213-534-8807. We got one about our Bill and Ted episode last week from Anonymous.
Hey, Wisecrack crew. I just listened to the Bill and Ted's episode, and just a precursor to my question, it's more of a statement. I'm from Latvia, and I have never seen this film before, but when I listened to your podcast on it, I was kind of curious to see if my reaction would be the same as Raymond's. And I have to say, yeah, the film kind of sucks. And I watched it with my kid, a 12-year-old, and my girlfriend as well, and none of us liked it. It was kind of boring, and I think this is purely nostalgia driven, and since I missed out, this was the first time seeing it, it just did not click for me. So just wanted to give my thoughts on that, and thanks for the great show, Ryan. I love you on Funhouse, and you know, keep up the good work.
Not for everybody, I guess. I mean, I do have that deep Bill and Ted nostalgia. Do you have it, Austin?
Yeah, I'm just going to have to say all that stuff that I just said earlier about me not being a fanboy. You're wrong, everybody else. Fuck you. This movie's amazing. This movie's fucking amazing. Okay? How dare you?
Oh, man.
Okay. I totally get it. And I almost am scared to revisit the film because I wasn't on last week's and I didn't rewatch it. But I am going to be rewatching it soon because obviously the third one just came out and I haven't watched it yet. But I'm going to be revisiting all three of them now, or the first two, and then I'm going to watch the third one. And I'm actually really nervous because I'm afraid that I'm...
No, don't be nervous. It's still good.
Okay. Like
I still love them.
I still have quotes that come into my head like all the time. So I fucking love it. Sorry, Evan, go ahead.
No, I said I'm just going to have to be Raymond here and say I don't get it. I didn't grow up with it. I watched it for the first time right before the podcast also just because I was like, you know what? I want to watch something I don't have to think too hard about. This movie sounds fun. You know, Jared has been talking about it. Amanda's been talking about it. I'll watch it. And I was like, okay.
I get pretty lukewarm on it. I can't really defend it much beyond that, so that's fair.
Yeah, and here's the thing, right. Like if it is just a nostalgia trip, what does that mean, right? Is it just that we're reliving our childhood? Are we blind, like our critical faculties are blinded by immaturity or like stunted growth or something? Like what is it that if it is nostalgia driven, that makes that worthy of critique or something like that. And is that okay, right? Because in a sense, maybe, I don't know, watching a fucking Jane Austen film is nostalgia driven based on some sort of like desire for fucking 19th century whatever life, you know? So is nostalgia bad? I mean, I'm not saying that there's no validity to that. I'm just more curious as a provocation. Let us think about that. Why would that be a bad thing, or why is that an okay thing?
I feel like that's a topic for a much longer discussion.
Yeah. Chew on it this week, everybody.
Yeah. I want to do one email from James. You can hit us up at movies@wisecrack.co. James says, I want to comment on Raymond's thoughts on people from the future showing up and telling two slackers that they are very important. I understand that he felt that their journey should have taught them to be better, but I look at it differently. Bill and Ted's philosophy of be excellent to each other and party on, dudes, was already a part of them. They did not need to learn what they already knew. Sure, the rest of their society might not put much value in their stance or the way they live their life, but their philosophy itself helped build a greater society in the future. That society was able to recognize their value even when Bill and Ted's own society might ignore it. I think it shows that if you are still able to keep a good attitude and treat others well, you matter. Whatever your lifestyle may be, just be a good person. Bill and Ted believe in being good to your fellow humans, and that should never be overlooked. There are many good people out there, but they may not be recognized, but they matter too. From James.
James gets it!
Yeah. Totally. I think that there's just something so warming about two slackers, two kind of burnouts, people that society would normally discard, and seeing just how excellent they are to each other.
And I'm an academic, so you would think that I like love all things intellectual and brainy, and I don't sometimes. Like, I'm an academic, but I'm also just kind of a dude, you know? And so sometimes wisdom comes out of the mouth of babes, which is a line from the Bible, right? And we oftentimes we're like, oh, these stupid surfer bros, they don't know. No, the profundity of be excellent to each other and party on, dudes, supersedes any intellectualization over ethics and shit like that. So fuck, man. Like, sometimes that's just the truth, you know? The stupid shit is the real shit, I think, is something that Childish Gambino said at one point. And yeah, that's it.
Hell yeah. All right, we're going to wrap it up here. Where can we find you guys on the internet, Evan?
Well, I produce videos here, so you can see, you know, every video that comes out, I got my hands on it. And yeah, I guess you can follow me on Letterboxd at, I think it's at Ye Olde Evan or Evan JY, one of the two. Yeah.
And Austin.
Yeah, hit me up on Twitter, Austin_Hayden. I'm on Insta, AUS_HAY. I do a philosophy podcast called Owls at Dawn. That's why I'll be rewatching all the Bill and Ted films, actually. We felt a little bit like you stole our thunder because we were like, fuck, man, we were going to do it, and you guys beat us to the punch. So this will be a supplement.
I don't think we have plans on doing 2 and 3.
Okay.
So that's all you, buddy.
Okay, perfect.
I did see 3, by the way. I won't spoil anything, but okay. All right. I'll just leave.
Nothing. I don't want to know anything.
I'll tell you that I paid $20 for it.
Let me ask you this. No, I'm not going to say no. I don't even want to ask. No, nothing. I want to know.
Okay.
I literally have not looked at any reviews except all I wanted to see was just like, was it positive or not? And I gave myself this allowance to look at one tiny headline, and it just said something about how the chemistry between Winters and Reeves was still great. And I'm like, that's all I want to know. That's fine. So I took that, and that's good enough for me. As long as they have chemistry, that's what I was afraid of, that it was going to be like these two 50-year-old dudes, a guy who's been making fucking documentary films on like Anonymous, and then fucking Keanu and John Wick are coming together, and they're like just totally different humans, and they don't have it anymore. And that's what I was worried about. But if that's not the case, then I trust both of them.
All right, well, you're in for a good time.
Yeah.
All right, we're going to wrap it up there. We'll see you guys in 2 weeks. And then also, email us, let us know if you like us doing more video games. This is just something I wanted to try out. I know Austin had played it. It's not often that Austin is playing games. It's not often that we've played the same games, so I figured we would try this out.
And if you really have to twist my arm, I have a PS4, and if I must play a video game for work, then it's okay.
Okay, cool. All right, guys. We'll see you next time.
See ya.
Peace.
Peace.